Hello and welcome to the Let's Talk Bipolar podcast, hosted by Emma Bell and brought to you by Bipolar UK. You can find all of our resources at www.bipolaruk.org. Welcome to this episode of Let's Talk Bipolar by Bipolar UK. And my guest this week is Oliver Seligman. And he is an author and an inspirational speaker and someone who lives with bipolar. So welcome, Oliver. How are you today?
I'm very well, thanks.
Thank you so much for coming on the show. I'm really excited to talk to you. You have a very interesting story and I'm looking forward to unpacking that with you.
Me too.
So could you start by introducing yourself and telling us a little bit about how bipolar has shown up for you in your life and what that's kind of looked like? Because I can see it's been quite a long journey for you.
Yeah, sure. I'm 46 years old. And when I was 17, in my final year of school, I started to gradually become more and more manic. Mm-hmm. And this mania got worse and worse until I ended up in a mental hospital in Edinburgh, being given a medication called haloperidol to bring me down. Mm-hmm. The haloperidol was very good at bringing me down, but it brought me way down because the doctors didn't realize how sensitive I was to it. There was no reason they could have done. And so then I went into a drug-induced depression for a few weeks, which was the worst experience in my life. And then slowly, with the help of the staff at the hospital, I started to get better and better and better. They mm-hmm. gave me antidepressants, which seemed to work really well. And then I spent the next couple of years trying to find myself again, trying to get back to where I was before, but it didn't really work. And I kept having depressive episodes, or I had a lot of anger, a lot of anxiety. Life just wasn't really going very well. Even though I started university, there were times when I loved university, but most of the time it was just a really big struggle because I was having such a struggle in my own mind, as I'm sure a lot of the listeners know about. Mm-hmm. So then after, I think, a couple of years of being diagnosed, my psychiatrist recommended that I start taking a medication called lithium. Mm-hmm. And he said that he'd wanted to wait a while because it's the kind of medication that if I started it, I might never be able to stop it. And I said, yeah, go for it. If anything that's going to make me happy, I'm up for it. Mm-hmm. So I started taking lithium and it worked really very well. I didn't have any manic episodes and I didn't have any depression at all. But there were quite a few significant side effects that I had from it. Mm-hmm. The most obvious being that I stopped feeling my emotions mm-hmm. in the ways that I'd felt them before. Everything was a lot flatter. I lost the subtleties of my emotional inner compass. So judging situations and other people and the sensitivities of life kind of disappeared. And I also became quite hypomanic a lot of the time. Now, that may or may not have been because of the lithium, but the fact was that the lithium stopped that going into a mania, which was great. But it also meant that I lived at 100 miles an hour, taking a lot of risks, sleeping around, partying, not really caring very much about anything for quite a few years. So mm-hmm. I lived in this hypomanic state that became me to the extent that no one even suspected that I was hypomanic, including myself. I was
because
just
it just became
strung.
Your personality. It just became who you were, what you did, and what do you mean like that? It just became who you were. This is how you are. And so no one questioned it.
That's exactly it. This is how I am. And I had been like that beforehand too for periods of time. So it wasn't like it was this sudden change. Mm-hmm. I'd had it in my personality since I can remember. Mm-hmm.
It's hard, isn't it, to filter out what's me, my personality, and what is symptomatic or exasperated by having bipolar. And it's sometimes difficult when you're kind of going through these phases where you're trying to work out what medication works for you, what work, you know, what do I need to do? It's hard to filter out what's what, isn't it? I've definitely in the early days found that very difficult to work out what was truly me and what was actually, you know, a symptom that was being sort of pushed to its limit, really. So tell me more about what happened. So you've been on lithium then at this point, which is stopping the mania coming, which is great, but we're living in this very heightened space. And how long would you say that went on for you?
I think on and off, it went on for about 8 to 10 years. But I had a lot of fun. Yeah. And I achieved a lot of things.
That's it. Yes. Yeah. Yes. Achievement can be very high. It's something that so many of us speak about. And, you know, so many of us wouldn't have achieved half of the things we've achieved without this streak of, you know, brilliance, bipolar brilliance.
That's a great way to put it.
What can we say? Hey, April speaks about it. She said her dad said to her when she got diagnosed that he always thought there was something, I think I can't remember exact words, but something to that effect, you know, always thought there's something, you know, like this brilliance within you. I can't remember the exact word, but it was that, right? Because there's so many things that are hard about bipolar, and there are some things that are borderline magical that, you know, that I look back on in certain periods of my life and I think, wow, did I do that? And we look back and look at things and think, oh my God, did I do that? And then there's some things we look back on and go, wow, I did that. So, you know, it's, yeah, it's full of all the things, isn't it? So this went on for about 10 years. And then what happened for you next?
Well, then I learned to meditate. And that started to definitely help with the hypomania. Over time, it started to make me a more calm, relaxed person. Mm-hmm. So that had a really positive influence.
Mm-hmm. Mindfulness is really helpful, isn't it?
I've never done mindfulness actually, but the meditation I do has been a lifesaver actually.
I think anything that's like meditation, it's all being mindful, isn't it? Meditating is being mindful too, right? It's intentional. It's time that you sit down and you intentionally do something, and there's mindfulness to that. Because I've gone through periods in my life where I've definitely not been mindful of anything. I don't know about you. I felt like life's like, you know, life is happening to me rather than I'm living life.
Yeah, I definitely understand that.
So you started meditating, and then did your medication change, or has that stayed the same?
Well, actually, after I'd been on lithium for about 20 years, the side effects started to get worse and worse. And I got to this place where I couldn't really concentrate on anything. I could no longer read books and things like that. Mm-hmm. And my memory was absolutely shot. And throughout my whole period of being on lithium, I used to get this an incredible amount of aggression that would hit me from time to time. And obviously the physical effects of just weak muscles and achy muscles and being dehydrated and headaches and all those things, they just got worse and worse over the years. And at the same time, I started meeting people who were telling me this, because before this point, I hadn't really taken any interest in bipolar at all. I hadn't read anything about it. I hadn't studied it. I thought, you know, I just take my pills and I keep going and I'll be fine. That was very much the mentality when I was originally diagnosed. So what happened was I thought, well, I need to try and come off this medication, but I need some help doing it. So I got a psychiatrist, started trying to come off it. It all went totally wrong. Sorry, let me just go back a little bit. I started trying to come off it on a meditation retreat without any support whatsoever, having not told any doctors. This, I think, was probably part of the hypomania, and it was also part of just not knowing the risks, you know, not have really being sort of not knowing about this side of mental illness. And I started to hallucinate, and I started to see people as dragons and all these weird realms. And then I went back on the lithium. And then I thought, well, I'll try again. A couple of months later, I did the same thing, had the same result. But then the real kind of, it really came to a head when I was in Australia, and I'd been coming off my meds, lithium, for probably, I'd probably taken 7 or 8 months to do it. So I thought I was doing it very slowly, but still without any psychiatric help. And I went completely mad. And I ended up being sectioned, being arrested in Australia and taken to a mental hospital, having climbed onto roofs, thinking I was an angel. And by some sheer miracle, I didn't jump off because I was sure I could fly. And I was going to jump off and fly, but I didn't. I was looking at the pot plants and talking to them and sort of licking my finger and placing it on them because it would bless them. You know, I thought I was the Messiah, this whole crazy, crazy world. And so I ended up on the other side of the world without any family within, you know, 3,000-4,000 miles, however far it is, and just some friends that I've been living with. And that was a hell of a shock too. But my kind of desire to be off lithium and this kind of idea that I could do it, I kept going with it. I kept pushing myself. And this continued for probably another, I think about 4 years in total. I sort of tried coming off it and failed and tried and failed and failed. And yeah, it was a pretty miserable experience.
So tough. Changing medication is not to be underestimated. Coming on, coming off, making changes. You're right, we need more support than I think we think we do in those transitions. If nothing else, for someone else's professional perspective on us, which is difficult to keep on ourselves, right? When we go through a big shift in mood, keeping that perspective on ourselves is incredibly tough. I'm so sorry that you ended up in that situation, so far away from your family and support.
Yeah. And then what happened? Then basically, this is where the good news starts. Basically, after, I suppose, in total, over a 10-year period of trying to come off and not, but after sort of a 4.5 really tough years, which was really tough for me and for my family as well, I woke up one morning in a mental hospital in Norway, where I've been living for the past 15 years. And suddenly it was like the penny dropped. It was suddenly as if I had found myself, and I realized that what I'd been doing was incredibly stubborn, and it wasn't being supported by life, and it wasn't working. And it felt like I almost grew up in that kind of moment of realizing. And I realized I need to go back on lithium. Of course I do. It was the only thing that worked for me. And so I went to speak to the doctors in the mental hospital, and they were very supportive. They've been very supportive throughout the whole thing. And they said, sure, no problem. And in my book, I describe what it's like to start taking lithium again, having been off it completely for 2.5 years, and just the fear and the anxiety and noticing every single effect it had on my body, you know, from my brain starting to get more solid and the creativity starting to just sort of disappear, and this numbness, but also this safety coming in, the safety of the emptiness of the medication. It was a strange experience. So this is what happened in this room on my own at night, just having taken the lithium. And for a moment, there was this intense fear where I was just, oh my God, this is it. I'm losing myself again forever. And then that kind of went, and the sort of the drug induced sleep just took me to sleep. And from then on, I've been on lithium and I've been much, much better. Unfortunately, because of the way that the hospital did it, it's a hospital in Norway. They're very good in the way they treat patients. In my experience, they're very much about working with the patient rather than telling the patient what to do. Yeah. So it creates an environment where people are more likely to cooperate with the doctors. Yeah. The treatment that I got in Britain, or some of the treatment, was very much, you should do this. And immediately this resistance comes up. And I think especially for us with bipolar, we tend to be quite free spirits.
Yes.
You know, and when someone says you have to do this, immediately resistance comes. But in Norway, they were much more kind of like, we think maybe you should, or what do you think? And asking me loads of questions and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. So they said to me, look, it's a really good idea if together we can just experiment with finding the right dose for you. We'll try and find the lowest dose possible, that the side effects are as low as possible, but you can still be stable. Mm-hmm. And so we did that over about a year and a half. And so now I'm on a much lower dose than mm-hmm. I was originally. And I'm not quite as stable in that, for example, on the higher dose of lithium, I could just fly to America and I wouldn't even think about the consequences. Mm-hmm. You know, it was like, I just didn't even, there was no fear in my experience at all. Mm-hmm. Whereas now I'd have to plan it and really check that I wanted to do that. And is it worth the risk? And, you know, mm-hmm. but the side effects, I don't have nearly as many. So mm-hmm. that's brilliant. And mm-hmm. and I'm a very sort of, I'm a very happy person and have been for a long time.
That's great. And I think there's a lot in what you've just said there about feeling like you have autonomy on your own care plan is so important. And that collaborative approach to building your care plan is the difference between someone getting on board with the care plan and someone rejecting the care plan. And I think there's so much, isn't there, that, like I was saying before, you can feel like life just happens to you, which doesn't really feel like you're in control that much. And I think any opportunity that we get to feel like we are still in charge of ourselves is welcomed. So that collaborative approach is going to be more successful with people that are living with bipolar, because they can feel like, oh, I've got a say in my care, which of course any human wants a say in how they're looked after and what they're putting in their body. Of course we do. Otherwise it will just be met with defensiveness, resistance, denial, and all of these other things. So there's so much in what you say that I know is so important and matters to people living with bipolar. And so like, for example, the care I get here is my psychiatrist, because I've done the research and I know what's what and I've tested things and this and that, I'll go to him and I'll say, this is where I'm at and I think I would like to try this before you come at me with another suggestion. You know, I'd like to try this first, you know, and he lets me do that. And that means that it works better, you know, because I'm never feeling, I don't know, bullied into something, you know, which is just not a nice way to feel, is it?
No, I think that's brilliant. I think in some ways that's perhaps one of the most important things for people who are receiving treatment of any kind, but particularly treatment for their mind. Mm. Is that we feel that it's a cooperation. We feel that our feelings are being taken into consideration, even though we haven't done the training in mental health that doctors and nurses have done. It's like when you're dealing with kids, if you can get them on board, then it's so much more successful for everyone. And absolutely. I think it's incredibly true with psychiatry.
Absolutely. And the thing is, we're not trained psychiatrists, but we live with us every single day. We're the ones that have to live with the side effects, live with the fallout, live with the numbness that comes with certain medications, and finding a balance of what works for you. And it might not be textbook perfect. That's the thing in what you're saying, right? It might not be textbook perfect. It might not be the therapeutic dose that's recommended. And it, you know, for me, for example, the medication that I like to take when I'm not doing fertility treatment is a little lower than perhaps what a professional might really recommend for me. And it allows me to feel enough that I feel like I'm living. And yes, I have to work a bit harder at staying stable than I would if, you know, if I took a higher dose, I probably wouldn't have to work quite as hard. But it means that I feel like I'm living, not just existing. And that's massive.
That's exactly my experience. You couldn't have said it better.
Yeah, it's just massive, isn't it? Because just feeling like you're existing is so hard. And just a few minor tweaks with medication, I think, can be successful for people. And I will caveat it with, if you have other tools in the toolkit other than medication to help you stay stable. So like getting to know bipolar. Like you said, you know, I'd never really researched it. And then you did, right? Then you went and found out about it. And that makes a massive difference to the awareness level we have with staying well. And it can be the difference between us taking a higher dose of something and a lower dose of something. Because on a lower dose of something, if we're more aware of what's going on around us, maybe we can manage those things a little bit, you know? But we have to take charge of our own stuff, right? We have to make the expert on ourselves to get the care that we need. It's so important.
That's cool. Yeah, it's funny you say that, because I actually, in my book, I go through some of the stuff that kind of has really helped me to stabilize myself.
Mm.
And there's a lot of different stuff. I mean, from obviously medications there, psychotherapy, mm-hmm. Taking action, mm-hmm. getting out of my comfort zone has been very good for me. Humor, very important to learn to laugh at ourselves and all true. These crazy things we go through.
Very true.
Giving to other people is another one to get us out of ourselves, get us helping, feeling good about ourselves. Purpose, mm-hmm. and we don't have to have like a grand life purpose, you know, we don't need to save the world or anything like that, but just to see the purpose in what we do, mm-hmm. even the simple things, like if we're taking out the trash, can we take it out for our family rather than just taking it out, because that mm-hmm. gives a different dynamic to it.
Mm-hmm.
A whole load of things, but it's, yeah, you talk about the toolbox, it's quite fun how much can be in the toolbox.
Mm-hmm. And I do think, for me anyway, in the first instance, the only tool I had in my toolkit was a psychiatrist and medication. And it kept me alive. It saved my life, for sure. You know, being on a really high dose of an antipsychotic for me saved my life. And I didn't have any other tools in the toolkit. But once I started to get stable, I had to learn everything I could about this diagnosis, learn all the things, listen to all the stories, you know. Get informed, because when you're informed, you can be more empowered in your own care plan. Because when someone comes to you and says, well, I want to do this, you can say, well, I've been thinking about this and this, and maybe we could try it, right? And you can start advocating for yourself and find crafting your bespoke plan, because it's different for everyone. So where are you living now?
At the moment I'm living in Edinburgh, but normally I live in Oslo.
Okay. And you are now in a place where you're feeling very stable. And before we go on to talk about the next bit, actually, I'd just like to ask you a question about something you said. You said at the beginning you got put onto lithium and went into a drug-induced depression.
Haloperidol,
sorry, beg your pardon. And that put you into a drug-induced depression. Which you said was a really, really dark time for you. Are you comfortable to share a bit more about that?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I've experienced quite a few depressions over the years, you know, pretty much all of which I've wanted to kill myself at different times. But the drug-induced depression was a completely different kettle of fish. It was like being immersed in hell constantly, where there was no hope. Nothing that anyone could do would make anything any better. The whole time I was like just being ripped apart by my mind and just in a sea of despair, basically. I couldn't go to the toilet by myself. I couldn't eat. So after 2 weeks, the doctors were going to put me on like a tube down my mouth to eat. Luckily, I started to actually get better just before they did that. It was just like pure unadulterated hell. And what is so bad about it is that when you're experiencing it, you experience it forever. It's not like, oh, I can get through this. It's like, this is how everything is forever.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a terrible experience. And yeah.
So sorry that happened to you. And how did you manage to get out of that space? Was it a medication change? What was it that happened for you to bring you out of that space?
Well, I think that the reason I went into it was because I've been manic for such a long time.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's always a depression after a mania.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously the drugs brought me down, but the problem with the haloperidol was that they had to give it to me for a couple of weeks, and then they had to take me off the haloperidol and everything else. Like, so I couldn't take any medication for 2 weeks before they could give me the antidepressants. So there was like a clean out period in my body. And so basically the antidepressants started to kick in, and also the withdrawals from the haloperidol, because there can be very severe withdrawals, they started to lessen. So between the two, I started getting better. I mean, it was obviously, I was very lucky because I had my parents coming to visit me and the people in the hospital were very, very kind. But if I'm honest, I don't think any of those things made any difference at that stage because it was just too severe. It was just too chemical. Mm-hmm. So I put my recovery, at least initially, down to the antidepressants and the fact that I was safe in hospital.
Yeah.
And then once I started to get a bit better, then these other factors could start to make a difference. That's what I experienced.
But did they recognize that that was what was happening and that's why they stopped the haloperidol, or were they due to stop it anyway?
No, they recognized that it had taken me too far down.
Okay.
Yeah.
Slowed you down too much.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh. I mean, yeah, managing mania is obviously critical, and then the inevitable fall afterwards also is something that has to be really carefully watched, because a depression like that is just, you know, an awful place to be for anybody. So thank you for sharing that. I was just curious about that. And then, so now you're in a good place now. You went back on lithium and you've got a dose that feels right for you. Side effects are okay. Not too busy that we're risk taking without thinking. So things are quite stable, would you say, for you nowadays?
Yeah, for the last 5 or 6 years, I would say I've been stable and more at peace than most people, most psychiatrists anyway.
And you then decided to write a book.
I did.
Tell me how you arrived at the decision to do that and the process, and tell me more about that.
Cool. Can I show the book? Can I plug it?
Yeah, of course. I'm going to put it in the show notes anyway.
This is it here.
Befriending Bipolar.
And there's a little bit of a ray of hope there.
Nice.
In the kind of stormy sea, the intense sea, that I think is probably maybe sums up what a lot of us experience with our mental health. You know, this kind of intensity and kind of grey. Parts of it are very beautiful as well. Mm-hmm. And then there's a ray of hope, which hopefully gets bigger and bigger for everyone.
Yeah. You know? Yes, I have that hope too. I talk about befriending bipolar a lot in everything that I talk about, and just on a personal level, I spent so many years fighting it, trying to beat it, trying to win, thinking if I just fought a bit harder, I could fight this and beat it and smash it. I don't know what I thought I was doing. And my life radically changed when I realized that, no, I've got to live with this forever. And guess what? This is the mate that's turned up that I didn't really want, right? But they've decided to be my best friend, even though I didn't really want them as a best friend. And I better get to learn to like them and how to, you know, how do I respect them? And, you know, oh God, they're going to be tagging along with me forever. Okay, so what do they like? What do they not like? What helps them stay well, you know? And that for me was a massive, massive shift in my journey with living with bipolar, was learning to live with it and actually befriend it rather than battle. So I, you know, I love the title of your book, because it's, for me on a personal level, is it was my pivot point, was learning, oh yeah, I've got this best friend that I never asked for, and I'm gonna have to be friendly with it. So I love the title of your book, and I'd love to know where and how you arrived at writing it. What was it like to write it? Tell me more.
Well, as soon as lockdown kicked in, I just knew I had to write a book on my experiences with bipolar. Mm-hmm. And when I started writing it, I had a few thoughts like, is this really a good idea? Do I really want to relive some of these parts of my life that weren't very easy? And I just thought, now I'm going to give it a go. You know, I am a great believer in fortune favors the brave. And I'm a great believer in pushing out of our comfort zones. Not all the time, that gets exhausting, but from time to time, I think it's really healthy. So I started writing it, and I absolutely loved every minute of it. Mm. I got closer to my parents and to my wife and my stepson. I got closer to some old friends who I talked to about what had gone on, trying to sort of find out exactly what was happening, because I'd forgotten a lot of things that had happened.
Yeah.
And I also, most importantly, I really, really, really started to come to terms with the illness. And I started to know more about it and more about who I was within it. So all in all, it was a fantastic experience. And one of the cool things about it was, because it was the right time for me to write the book, there was an incredible amount of support that came in to help me. So I had had a great editor who was my wife, and she's been an opera director. She's very good at making things interesting and exciting. I also had three different friends who offered to proofread it, all of whom are incredibly strict and love teasing me about how bad my English is. So that was incredibly helpful. They're like,
we need these people.
Yeah, absolutely. They're like school teachers, you know, they write in their notes like, I'm embarrassed to say.
Do you know, my husband's like that. He's very good at English and grammar. I'm terrible at it. At school, I loved maths, drama. I love talking to people. Terrible at writing. I'll do it, but it's shocking. You know, if anyone that's any good with English would be just, you know, be red pen all over the page. So I'm with you.
Yeah, that's good. Yeah, I like to think we give these people a lot of joy.
Yes. Yeah, I reckon they do get a lot of joy out of correcting our stuff. Yeah,
definitely. Yeah, definitely.
So you had some good proofreaders.
Yeah. Great editor, great proofreaders. Mm. I've written two other books, and this book is much better than the other books. Like, I've got better and better over time. And so I finished it really quickly, actually. I think I finished it in about a year. And then it was like, right, I got to get this out there. And people have asked me, you know, was it scary to sort of put it out there and to tell people you were bipolar and whatever? And my experience was actually no, wasn't scary at all. And I think the reason being that I had become so relaxed and friendly with the fact that I was bipolar. I was like, you know, if this can help people, or if people can read this and see themselves in it, then that's brilliant. Yes. And if it gives me the opportunity to get on podcasts and do talks and just to be a bit more of active in the world and actually doing something I believe in, then it's kind of a win-win for everyone. So I just started going with Instagram, which I never thought I'd be on. I thought I was going to be one of those old people who say, oh, I'm never doing social media. Now I quite like it.
It can be a good place. It can be a good place, Instagram. It depends what you're using it for, right? If you're using it for good, it's good.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. Like all these things.
Yeah.
So, and now I'm here, and now I'm doing podcasts, and I'm just sort of trying to get it out there, but I'm kind of relaxed about the way I do it. I don't have like any big goals. Oh, I want to sell this or do that or be really impressive. I've given that all up. I just want to help and contribute and have some adventures with it.
Yeah. Yeah. And I haven't read your book yet, but I will, when I get back to the UK in December next month, I will get your book and I will read it. And I know, just from all the people that are in my groups and things like that, I just know that the thing that helps people the most is hearing other people's truth, because it makes them feel not alone. And it, you know, sheds all of those thoughts of, I'm the only one that's ever been through this, I'm the only one that ever feels this. So what you've done is a huge gift to anybody that reads it, and will give back more than you'll ever know, right? Because people will read it and they may not tell you, and it will be silently giving and giving and giving. So I just think it's wonderful what you've done, putting your energy into that space. And I'm excited to read it when I get back. And I'm really grateful for your time today.
Well, thank you so much for interviewing me. It's been lovely to meet you. You ask brilliant questions, and you've got a lovely way about you. It's very easy to talk to you.
Oh, that's good. I hope so. I'm not a tyrant. No. What was I going to say? Where can everyone find you? What are your handles? Where can people buy your book? Tell us.
If you want to, you can buy my book on Amazon in paperback version or in Kindle. Mm-hmm. I have a website called befriendingbipolar.co.uk. I'm on Instagram I'm on Instagram @befriending_bipolar.
Lovely.
Yep, that's me.
Very good.
Oh, and one more thing. So I got a YouTube channel called Befriending Bipolar.
Brilliant. So Oliver, thank you so much. And this will be released in January. So I'll put all of Oliver's information in the show notes, and I will put the link to buy his book in the show notes. Go buy his book. And if you buy his book and read it, or you listen to this podcast, then please drop us a message and let us know what you think, and any feedback I will share with Oliver as well if you share that with me. So thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of Let's Talk Bipolar, the podcast brought to you by Bipolar UK. Please go to our website, www.bipolaruk.org, for all of our resources and all of the support that we can offer you.